Did it record so far?
Yes, everything recorded so far.
Good.
So,
no problem.
But
okay.
We were just talking about doctors and engineers and how that was a revered
profession
to go into.
Exactly. Not only that, it was, you know, by the time I was 15, 16, it was well accepted in the circles that I moved around in that, you know, the best education was available in graduate school in the United States. And so aspiring to go to the United States became a goal. We weren't allowed to leave the country, really, unless we had a scholarship or we had admission to one of the top schools in the country. And they had a list of 10 or 12 top schools in the country that one had to get into, and it was hard to get into them.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the very early days, as I can remember, I became a very conscientious student. You know, it became almost like a competition and a race to want to do well so that I could come to the United States, because that would be the best education the world had to offer. That became the goal.
Now, had anyone from your family gone to the United States?
Yeah, so my brother had come. But he's about 4 years older than I am. So he came to Case Western to get his bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. And I had decided that I want to come here for graduate school, not for college. I thought I would do my college work in India, and then I would be clearer about what I wanted to do
mm-hmm.
before I came here. And also I had never... I was young when I finished my high school and didn't want to leave home yet.
Yeah.
So at any rate, so I feel that the teachers I had in my high school influenced a lot of what occurred later in my life, in the sense that they pushed hard for being dedicated, being conscientious, being a team player, and they allowed people to achieve their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we had a peer election process. So we were organizationally divided into four houses, and I became the leader of one house, elected by my peers. And so there was some leadership potential emerging, some leadership drive
mm-hmm.
emerging, joined the Girl Scouts, learned more about leadership, things like that, you know.
Now, did you live at this school, or did you live at home?
No, I lived at home. I was a day scholar. So, no, they didn't, it was not a boarding school.
Okay.
So, but it was close enough that I could walk to it.
Oh, that's nice.
I remember... I have very happy memories of my high school days. And then I went to college in India.
Mm-hmm.
And college in India, I joined Bombay University. It was called Bombay at the time.
Yes.
Bombay University. And it's fashioned after the British system with lots of colleges in the university. So you pick a college that you want to go to depending on the expertise in that college. And I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to major in yet, and so I picked the school that was very highly regarded and was fortunate enough to get in. And the first 2 years, I kind of got a broad liberal arts kind of education, and then by the third year, I had to decide in which direction I wanted to go in, and I picked physics and math because, again, you know, that was where my interest began to mature,
mm-hmm.
and I enjoyed it very much. And the teacher, again, that I had in my junior year and senior year took a special interest in me and encouraged me to apply to schools in the United States, and that it was going to be a requirement to get very good grades, mm-hmm. and I'm going to have to be very conscientious and work very hard. So, you know, you can see how a personality evolves or an individual evolves depending on these sorts of influences. The home environment and the school teachers are who influenced me most. And
did you feel competition? Were there other students that you knew of who were you know, aiming for the same goal.
Absolutely, absolutely. There were, they were mostly men.
Mm-hmm.
My female friends wanted to go into the arts. They were very good at languages, at arts, and they were doing extremely well in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
Not many in math and science. There were a couple, I guess less ambitious than I was. They were perfectly capable of doing as well as I was doing, but, you know, other interests sort of took them in different directions.
Right.
You know, but it's one thing to be exposed to a small group of people among whom you can excel. And then you arrive in a place where everybody is brilliant. And it's a rude awakening, actually. So at any rate, I applied to several schools in the United States and you know, was anxious to come. Then the defining moment came when the letter, you know, an envelope arrived at home with an admission to Caltech with a scholarship, and oh boy, I'm going to have to leave home now.
Yeah.
It was a scary thought. So
now, had you hoped or tried to go to near Case Western where your brother was?
No.
Okay.
No. Why not? Because Case Western at the time wasn't in these top schools that was the list that
okay.
we were provided, where you could go even if you had to take a loan or something, because it, at any rate, I was only going if I could get a scholarship.
Right.
So when this envelope arrived, and you know, my first reaction was, of course, joy. I jumped for joy, but the next reaction was fear. Oh my God, you know, what have I done? But I took the courage, you know, got out of my comfort zone and came to this country. And at the time, they would only allow you to take $8 out of the country.
Oh, wow.
Eight. And I got on a plane with eight in my pocket and arrived in Pasadena, California, which, you know, was so different. It was a huge leap for me, culturally, academically, you know, never lived away from home, no shelter,
yeah.
No friends, not a soul that I knew. It was a very scary thought. When I think about it now,
sounds terrifying.
Sounds very terrifying. In today's world, it's even more terrifying, you know. In those days, there was peace in the world. But the world hadn't shrunk the way it has now. We didn't have television growing up in India. So we hadn't seen what the rest of the world looked like,
mm-hmm.
except in the movies, which is so make-believe, you know. And yet, everything seemed so new, so different. It was a steep, steep learning curve. But anyway, I arrived.
Now, before we move on to you arriving, when the acceptance letter came and it was clear that you were going to the United
yes.
States.
How did my parents
yeah,
react? Yeah,
I mean, they had always encouraged you.
You're right. So, you know, usually in homes in India, the sons are encouraged,
mm-hmm.
not the daughter.
Right.
Right. So this was very refreshing for me to see that my parents were quite thrilled and didn't dissuade me at all from wanting to do, to take this step. They were encouraging. They hoped I would return. In fact, my father just expected that, you know, I'd go for 2 years and I'd be back, and then he would find a nice man for me to marry. I mean, that was the norm.
Right.
And so I wasn't going to fight him on it. I didn't know yet what was going to come my way. So, in fact, I'm very, very pleased that they were as encouraging and modern in their outlooks in those days
mm-hmm.
as they were. So I was very fortunate. Just luck.
Yeah.
Lucky to be born into the household that, you know, because neighbors' households didn't have that kind of encouragement.
Do you have any idea what it was that made your family so much more.
You know, I think, you know, my father lost his father when he was relatively young,
mm.
and he could not pursue the education that he wanted to pursue. And he was very interested in learning new things, and he loved to learn. And so he would teach himself things.
Right.
And he was very keen that I would go into medicine, very, very keen, because he wanted to become a doctor.
Yeah.
But he had to become the main earner in the family when his father died. And so he gave up his education ambition and went into finance and the equivalent of Wall Street. You know, he became a broker.
Mm-hmm.
There was that lurking desire that I want to see my ambition fulfilled through my children, you know. So he encouraged all three of us to do what we wanted to do in our lives with education. That was important to him.
Now,
but none of us went into medicine, unfortunately for him.
But you all achieved.
We achieved
very high
levels of education, and we went completely different ways. My brother went back to India, became an entrepreneur, and started a new business. I stayed here and wanted to go into graduate school and higher education and then stay here. And my sister didn't come abroad at all.
Now, when you were growing up in Mumbai, did you have extended family nearby? I know that so
cousins
many,
and things.
Yeah, I know that so many families in India, the extended family is very close geographically.
Not a very big extended family. My father had only one sister.
Okay.
And they lived not too far away, and the kids were much older. She was much older. So they were like aunts and uncles, but in fact they were cousins. Nobody had come abroad. Nobody had gone into higher education. Certainly no woman in the family had. On my mother's side, there were two sisters, and the children, they lived in a city that was, an hour's flight away or an overnight train ride away. So I didn't see them except at Christmas time,
mm-hmm.
New Year's time.
Mm-hmm.
So we were close, but not that we frequently saw each other. I was very friendly with all the neighbors' children, and I had many, many, many friends that I maintain those friends today. Those ties are very strong even today. So the ones I formed in my high school, we were a group that just stayed together. We all went different ways. We live all over the world, but usually people come back in December for
mm-hmm.
the holidays. So we have grand reunions when I go back to Bombay. Yeah. It's interesting. We're not a very mobile society, so the people that grew up in Bombay, you know, they still go back to Bombay.
Right.
Because the families are there. But we can just pick up where we left off, you know. It's like we never went away.
How wonderful.
It is wonderful. Those are the strongest ties. Because, you know, you live together for 20 years of your life or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bonds are very strong.
Now, is your family, not just your friends, but is your family still in Mumbai?
In Mumbai, yes. My parents are no more. My brother lives in Mumbai. My sister lives in a city that is where my cousins were growing up.
Oh, okay.
A train right away.
Okay.
Yes.
Maybe it seems a little bit closer
yes.
now. Than
it does. And they have children. And they have grandchildren. So... now I have a much more extended family,
mm-hmm.
and they're sending their kids here, and so we are pseudo-parents to many
mm-hmm.
young ones, nieces and nephews. Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. You know, you get ready-made adults
yeah.
to raise them.
So then, when you came and when you arrived in Pasadena and knew no one and knew... You know,
it was very frightening.
You knew nothing.
I didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there was a gentleman with a sign that said, Uma, my maiden name was Dalal. And so I was relieved to see that there was somebody there to pick me up. He picked me up, and, you know, I had heard of LA freeways, but that first experience was terrifying.
I can imagine.
It was just terrifying. I was too shy and quiet to chat with this gentleman. I didn't know him at all. And he wasn't very talkative himself. So that was a strange guy to have sent to pick me up. But yeah, he was Indian. And anyway, so he brought me to this place, which was the first time Caltech had built a house for women to live in.
Okay.
Caltech was an all-male school.
Right.
There were no women around. It was a very small school. There were 1,200 people on campus. That was all. And there were no women in undergraduate school. And in graduate school, there were 30 of us.
Oh, wow.
And we were, and there was housing for 8 women. And so I was brought to this house, which I had the funniest of experiences. You know, he thought he was being very helpful, this gentleman. And he decided he's going to first take me to a supermarket. So he parks in the parking lot and says, "Why don't you go in and get what you want?" Well, I'd never been to a supermarket. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. So I watch everybody else. They're taking a cart and pushing it through. And I didn't know what to buy. I didn't have much money anyway. So I bought a toothpaste and went out. It was the funniest thing. I was so amused. I had a toothpaste in my suitcase. I didn't know what to buy. I didn't know what the house would have.
Right.
So, at any rate, he thought he was being very helpful. I went to this house, and all the rooms were taken. There was only, and all the single rooms were taken. There was one double room, which I would have to share, left. And so I got that room. And the first evening, I remember this one of the women. I mean, they were all very friendly, welcomed me. The one.
Now, were they all American?
They were all American and very California.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them comes up to me in the living room in the evening and says, "You know, the women here are highly emancipated." I don't know what the meaning of emancipation is. I remember having to go and look it up in a dictionary the next day. I was too afraid to ask. I was very frightened in my first month was...
Well, everything's completely different.
Didn't know up from down.
No.
But the professors were incredibly inviting, warm. You know, I just couldn't have asked for better reception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had the scholarship money waiting, so suddenly I was rich now. I had all of $280, and I didn't need any money, you know. The housing was cheap, the food was relatively cheap in those days.
Now, was the food any sort of adjustment?
Oh, yeah, I was very strictly vegetarian at
okay.
the time, right? Never eaten anything. I had eaten eggs and cheese and dairy products
mm-hmm.
and lots of vegetables. So I stayed vegetarian, but I remember it was hard because it was full of carbohydrates and
yeah.
no protein. And I remember putting on tons of weight. It's funny how things stick in your head, you know. And I have such a sweet tooth that we would eat desserts and ice cream. You know, I became very close friends with the women in the house.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, it's funny. 2 years ago, I tracked one of them down. I lost track with several of them, but one of them I traced down when we were in San Diego, and it was such fun. She invited me to her home. And there were pictures in one room of all of us.
Oh, how fun.
Walking down memory lane is so fun. And seeing all the women now with households and, you know, grown children
mm-hmm.
and in different walks of life. It's great. It's really great to meet up with people that you once knew so well.
Yeah.
And now they're doing things that are very different. Yeah.
Now, you said that the professors were very encouraging.
Oh, they were incredible. They were incredibly encouraging.
How were the classes? Did you feel academically prepared?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. like I said, you know, suddenly, you know, you're at the top of your class, wherever you come from, and then you arrive in this place, and holy cow, I couldn't understand what they were talking about in the first class I went to. This is graduate school. My undergraduate education did not prepare me for the courses I had signed up for, because
mm-hmm.
I came here with the ambition of becoming a nuclear physicist of international repute. That was my passion. And little did I know what that meant. I had no clue what it meant. And in today's world, I see, you know, when we recruit people from school, they're much more aware of what's going on in the world, much more aware of what they want to do. My first year, I was groping for trying to decide what direction I want to go in.
Mm-hmm.
So the first semester was very hard. I was not doing well because I couldn't understand a lot of the work. I worked day and night. And yet the professors completely understood that I was not quite ready for this level of graduate work. And so they offered me courses to make up for the gap.
Okay.
They offered me like tutorial help to make up for it. There were students that would teach me in the evenings to make up for what I didn't have in my education here. They were determined to have me succeed, which was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't have to do that. I remember this French professor saying, you know, if you're a little interested in this subject, I'll make you more interested.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave me a lot of projects to do for the summer, taught me lab work. You know, it was probably bachelor's level kind of work at the time, but I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew I had so much support from in the environment, I felt like I can make it.
Yeah.
I'll work hard enough. You know, I wasn't going to fail. I'm too determined.
Right.
And the first month, though, I was in tears every night. And in those days, you know, you couldn't even just pick up a phone and call. You had to book a call
yeah.
to India. And it took a week to get a call through to India. And when my father asked me how I was doing, I was weeping. And he said, well, then come back home. There's no way I was ever going to admit that I couldn't do it.
Right. Well, and you
too much
so
pride.
Hard.
I had worked so hard to get here,
yeah.
you know. So by the time I graduated, I was doing well,
mm-hmm.
And everybody helped me. The women in the house I stayed in helped me. The other senior graduate students helped me. I couldn't have asked for more. I feel really blessed by the kind of environment, the kind of professors. Discrimination, what is the meaning of discrimination? I never felt any at all. I would be in my Indian garb, you know, I wore a sari every day, so I was looked different, I spoke different, I had an Indian accent, but hey, I was even more special because I was so different, and everybody just was extremely warm, very welcoming. I don't remember a bad experience at Caltech at all, not at all. Everybody was very friendly.
Now, did you consider staying at Caltech to continue on?
Yeah, so, you know, I did consider that. When I was in India, in college in India, I had met a guy whom I had fallen in love with. And we communicated by writing letters while I was at Caltech for 2 years. And then he was coming to the U.S. And so I wanted to go where
yeah.
he was. And he was going to the University of Michigan.
Okay.
So I said, all right, I'll go to Ann Arbor. Well, as soon as he came, we decided, let's just get married. We hadn't seen each other in a couple of years. But we knew each other well enough to have made the decision. And so we got married.
Did you go back to India to get married?
No, because my parents didn't approve of that.
Oh.
That was not approved. That was not approved at all. So I was very unhappy about that aspect of it. Because I had to write a letter to my father with an impassioned plea to allow me to do this, but he didn't want me to. And I said I was very sorry, but this is what I was going to do. I was a rebel. I was rebellious.
Yeah.
And but I was very committed. And so we got married. And we decided, you know, we have to try to get into MIT and Harvard. And so we, the risks we took, it's, you know, as I think about it, it's pretty fascinating to me that anybody would even consider doing this. We did not have, we were told it's very difficult to transfer from one graduate school to another in mid-semester. So we, not having much money, not having a car, we got on a Greyhound bus and we went across in December into the midst of a snowstorm in Cambridge. And we walked into the chemistry department and we didn't have an appointment. And it was like December 23rd or 24th, and there was one door open and there was a secretary in there working, and she said, could she help us? And we said, well, we don't have an appointment, but we'd like to meet this professor. And she said, I'm very sorry, he's very busy, he's not gonna just see you. Who are you? We explained to him, graduate students, and my husband was very keen to go to Harvard, very, very, very keen. And so I think she took pity on us or something, but she allowed my husband to go and talk to the professor. I thought, you know, he'd be out in 5 minutes. 1 hour later, I'm sitting outside, he comes out and he says, gosh, that was terrific, we talked about chemistry. And he got in, it's amazing. And I got into MIT, so we just came across to Cambridge to graduate school. It was a stroke of luck, just pure luck. The stars were aligned. Maybe they admired the risk taking.
Yeah.
I don't know what they thought. You know, they didn't know us. Nobody knew us. We walk in off the street without an appointment, and the guy is willing to talk to us. Amazing, amazing.
What professor was it?
It was a professor of chemistry, Professor Frank Westheimer. He changed my husband's life.
Yeah.
And mine, therefore.
Yeah.
In many ways. I walked into MIT and, you know, I said I had, this isn't, I just walked in and we, not at the same time. We went back and waited to hear from Harvard, and I figured I can get into MIT. I got finally got good grades from Caltech, I can get into MIT. They're sister schools.
Yeah.
And
probably good recommendations.
Good recommendations. So it was no problem for me to get into graduate school at MIT. They were very kind again. Oh my God, they were so kind. I've only met just the most amazing professors. And so they became my role models, you know. So I wanted to become a professor. I wanted to become an academician. By this time now, I'd given up that I was going to become a nuclear physicist and I'd become a materials person, material scientist. And I had so much fun at MIT. It was a great school.
Now, who did you work for when you were at MIT?
I worked for a professor by the name of Bob Coble, C-O-B-L-E. He was a fun-loving, brilliant, material scientist that kind of wrote, I mean, his name is on many theories in the processing of ceramics, but he wasn't a very good teacher, but he was a very good mentor and encouraging of his students, and lots of parties, we had lots of fun while we were studying. we were a very close knit group, and we email each other still. And it was like a mini UN. There was a Japanese, there was a Chinese, there was me, there were four or five other students. Some of them became professors. Yeah, yeah.
Now, were you the only woman in the
group? I was the only woman.
Okay.
There were some other women in graduate school.
Okay.
At MIT had quite a few women, unlike Caltech, which
right.
was all male. MIT had quite a few women. But not in my group.
Did that matter at all?
Oh, no.
Okay.
You know, I've decided that in science and technology, gender doesn't seem to affect scientists. They are very interested in science.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're interested in science, they're very welcoming of you. Unlike, if you were in manufacturing, is a very different environment from a research environment. I have not felt gender discrimination or discrimination that I was from another country, from a different color, different everything, and yet I never ever felt, in fact, I felt special. I've had a very lucky set of experiences. So it's not what many women have gone through, and I can empathize with that as I see other women struggling through their careers to get to wherever they get. It can be a pretty cruel world. I was just lucky. Born under the right stars, I guess.
Yeah.
The right halo above me. I was very fortunate. And then when we graduated, it was going to be difficult to find two jobs in one place where one of us would have to compromise something.
Yeah.
This was the industrial research lab that was really talked about. There were very few industrial research labs.
Now, before we get into that, you had said that at a certain point you had wanted to go into academia
yeah.
and be a professor.
Yes.
So
what changed?
Yes.
What changed? So as I started doing independent research, that was the big leap at MIT. I'd never done completely original,
mm-hmm.
independent research. That was the first time. That now it's an expectation even of bachelor's level
right.
degrees, but it wasn't in those days, and I'd never done it. But to successfully graduate, I had to, and that challenge made me think about the kinds of things I would like to do the research on, and what did it mean to the world if I did this?
Mm-hmm.
How would it make a difference to the world? Could I impact people's lives in any way? Could I make their lives better because of the research I've done? And the funding had come from the Department of Energy. What was at that time called something else?
Yes, I can't recall what,
it was called something.
But it became Department of Energy.
Yeah. Atomic Energy Division?
Something like that, I think.
Something like that. Anyway, that was where my professor's grants were from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so we had to do something that was energy related. And I worked on what was pretty basic science. It was the physics and chemistry of solid materials and the insights gained from that science could lead to applications in things like solid oxide batteries.
Mm-hmm.
So, batteries are a
yep.
problem ever since I can remember. And, soldiers in the field at the time would want something that was lighter, smaller,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff. So the need hasn't changed over the years. We just have learned lots of things over the years that have made life a lot better, but not good enough.
Yeah.
So I became interested in learning about the real world and how research and science can impact the real world. And I thought if I went, I thought about academia versus industry, and came to the conclusion I could make more of a difference if I was in industry. I felt like my interest lane started to evolve more into things more applied than more basic.
Right.
Whereas I had come from India with a desire to go more basic, but I changed completely. All based on the influences of courses, of, I don't know, world events or what. I'm not quite sure what, but...
Well, and as you said, it's sometimes just what sparks your
what
interest.
What sparked my interest at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I started learning more about practical things. So this was the closest we could come to. GE and DuPont were the closest we could come to academia and yet be in industry.
Mm-hmm.
And have the potential to actually commercialize something. So we applied here, and again, stroke of good luck, because you know, 70s were not a good time to get a job.
No.
Not at all. And mid 70s, you know, DuPont was going through a lot of soul searching on and cutting a lot of cost. But they had begun hiring because they had decided they want to get into the life sciences at the time.
Okay.
In the late 70s. And my husband was a chemist, but wanting to do biology and biotechnology. And I wanted to do material science, and they were looking at things like battery materials in central research at the time. So again, luck, stroke of good luck. And so we were both given offers.
Now, did you guys consider applying maybe in Europe or... You know, you'd already made this one really big move from
India.
No,
we didn't. We thought the chances of both of us getting industrial research jobs, and you know, by that time already, there was a will to hire women into research,
right.
And there was already, we were the first couple to be hired at the experimental station. They'd never done that before. And they'd never hired a couple into the same department. That was unheard of. That was like nepotism. But we were fortunate again. You know, we were in completely different divisions and hardly saw each other at work because we were in such different fields. But we were fortunate to get two jobs in one place.
Yeah.
And so we came here. And I remember the first 6 months we'd run up to Cambridge every opportunity. We'd just drive up to, by now we had a car, and we'd drive up to Cambridge. Because we missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And this felt like, you know, going to the deep south.
Right.
And it was different. Wilmington today is very different from what it was in those days, in
I
the 70s. It was very beautiful, the countryside. But it was not the kind of academic and lots of youth and cosmopolitan
mm-hmm.
environment we had become accustomed to.
Right.
6 years in Cambridge and Harvard
right.
and MIT was a different experience from coming here. But, you know, it grows on you little by little. And the DuPont company has been amazing for me to work in. Just amazing. I came into Central Research, which again was a welcoming environment. I cannot say that I ever felt gender discrimination. Now, maybe I have a thick skin and I'm a little oblivious to what people say, but I never ever heard any commentary that did not feel like if you were interested in science, well, you know, go for it. In those days, the attitude here was you hire great scientists. And you allow them to follow their passion.
Mm-hmm.
And they will do good science, and that science will find application. There wasn't a directed program I was given
mm-hmm.
when I arrived, which is quite different today.
Yes,
I mean, we are very project-oriented, market-driven. That was very much a technology-driven culture at the time. This is 33 years ago, so you weren't born yet. And it was amazing to me that there was that kind of academic environment. So I felt like I was just in an amazing place, because mm-hmm. there were experts on no matter what subject I was getting interested in. And at school, I had to do everything myself. You know, all the analytical work, even the building of the equipment I had to do.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they had one technician for all the graduate students. And there were many of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he would teach you how to use lathe and machine your own tool. So I wasn't very good in the laboratory, is what I've decided. But I did enjoy the research and was very happy to have done what I did, and was incredibly happy up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But
using the lathe and things, that wasn't
necessarily
for you.
The mechanical did, and it just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
I became very interested in microstructures, you know,
mm-hmm.
what goes on at the micro and nano kind of level
yeah.
in materials, and how does that affect the properties of those materials.
Yeah, before nano was such a
before nano was
key,
you know,
phrase.
exactly. So the research environment here was very open, and there was money to buy all kinds of exciting equipment. And so this analytical, I remember asking to buy a $1 million microscope at that time.
Oh, wow.
$1 million microscope. And, you know, they heard my story. It was amazing that we got approval. This is about my fifth or sixth year. We got approval to buy this incredible microscope. We still have it. And you could analyze the chemical content of a material, and you could view at the atomic level with that kind of resolution. It was just fascinating. So the research environment at DuPont, I was very, very happy with. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Central Research was just the perfect place for me to work. And I was in a catalysis group working on, and so I began by working on battery materials, because that's what I had done.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to work on proton conductors. And then I slowly gravitated towards catalysis, because so much of the company was working on chemical processes that involve heterogeneous catalysis. So I started to form friendships with people outside Central Research, and started establishing a network of people that I would go talk to. I tended to make friends with people who were considered, you know, fellows or DuPont fellows or research fellows. I would go find the best scientists I could, because I knew that's where I would get the best advice.
Right.
So I was intuitively a networker.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and made friends with people that would be very stimulating to be around. And so I was very fortunate in that about 4 years after I'd been here, they suggested that I lead a group. So they must have seen some leadership potential. I said I wanted to...
Well, probably going and seeking out answers from DuPont fellows and things like that. I mean...
It's just showed initiative.
It does, it does. It shows initiative and confidence. And
yeah. And in catalysis, you know, when you're working on these large processes, it takes a multidisciplinary team.
Mm-hmm.
And so they figured I could lead a multidisciplinary team, because I was good at bringing teams together. And, you know, the egos are very tall among scientists,
yes.
especially the best ones. And that was not one of my strengths, I would say. Egos, I just didn't have any. It didn't bother me to ask for help. It didn't bother me to be one of them and yet be the leader. You know, that was the transition I went through. So I was the group leader of this group, but I was also had a lab.
Okay.
So I was one of the people doing the work, but I was also the leader of the group. So I would convene the meetings. I would bring together the story of what, if you integrated the work of the group, we could tell a story.
Right. But people at this time still had the freedom to pursue.
They were pursuing, but then we started becoming more goal-oriented.
Right, okay.
By then we had started to get more goal-oriented. If you're working on a process, then the end point is clear of what you want. DuPont already operated this process in one of its plants,
okay,
but wanted a new chemical route to achieve the same compound. And so we were working on chemical catalysis.
Okay.
I was doing more of the microstructure and the processing of the catalyst. Then there were engineers who were doing the reaction engineering. There were people who were analyzing the products. There were people designing the chemical groups, you know. So we had about six people of different disciplines.
Yeah.
And trying to approach it from a basic science standpoint, but trying to understand the fundamentals of the mechanism of the reaction so that we could improve the process. So that was the goal.
Did you have to travel
to the plant? No, I wish we had done more of that. I did go once, and I was just blown away by the enormity and immensity of it. Learned a lot,
mm-hmm,
in those days. And the manager of the group, of which I was a group leader, was very helpful to me. I can't tell you how I got all this help. I must have been one of those people that needed help or whatever, but I always found people that provided a lot of help.
Yeah.
And
that's
That's what allows you to, and then they create opportunities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a supervisor, then from a group leader.
Okay.
Then I started gravitating towards management. And
so when you were a supervisor, did you still have a research lab? Or
no, now
at that
I no
point
longer.
You were...
I transitioned by
okay.
then. By that time, I transitioned. It was about 84, 85, something like that. And at the time, I was asked to lead a different kind of group where we would bring together researchers from different, this was the first time we tried this experiment, that I would be the leader of a corporate effort in ceramic materials where we would work on electronic applications, but these folks would come from electronics, they would come from engineering, they would come from our fibers department, so from our chemicals group. So this was a very unusual thing for central research to attempt. And I didn't know how committed people were. I remember looking for corporate commitment before accepting this assignment because I said, you know, I'm more than happy to try the experiment. I have no idea if it's going to work. Because people were not going to move out of their departments, but I'm supposed to, by influence, manage this group and try to align everybody towards a specific goal.
Right.
That was a challenge. It uses a different part of your brain, I guess.
And did it prove successful after time, that challenge?
I think moderately successful. I mean, we did come up with a product that became commercial, so
okay.
that's success.
Yes.
It didn't turn out to be a huge business, but a small business, but at that time very relevant to what electronics department was working on. It was very enjoyable, and at about that time, and I got to build the group because I was told I could go out and hire whatever I needed to develop ceramic materials for electronic packaging. That was the goal. And my PhD work had been in ceramic materials.
Right.
So the fact that the DuPont company had become so interested in ceramic materials came as a very pleasant surprise to me. And I knew a lot of people. I was part of the American Ceramic Society. I had become a fellow of the American Ceramic Society. So I knew a lot of people in the field. I knew professors. I knew students. I knew people who were going to graduate. So I hired a lot of people.
Hired them into DuPont?
Into DuPont,
okay.
Into Central Research. And several of them are around in the labs, have become senior professionals. And I built the ceramics group.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun, enjoyed it thoroughly, got a lot of support for it. About that time, there was news in the world that people had discovered, actually came from IBM labs in Zurich, that people had discovered a superconductor
mm-hmm.
that worked at liquid nitrogen temperature, which was the highest temperature people had discovered to date.
Right.
Much excitement. I remember driving to New York City to hear about this breakthrough in superconductor physics. There was a big convention at a Holiday Inn or Hilton, one of those hotels. And I remember walking, there were crowds that were trying to get into the hotel, into this convention. It was impressive. And these IBM physicists, who later got a Nobel Prize, were speaking. And I wanted to get into the room. You could barely get in. And
wow.
They closed the doors after a while. But they put up closed-circuit televisions, and people were squatted all over the staircases. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this. But it was the most amazing experience. And so it was big news. It was in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, you know, all over the place. And Central Research Management said, anybody who wants to work on this may work on it.
Wow.
About 20 people raised their hands, and I got asked to lead this group, which was a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah.
So we worked night and day. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. We produced 20 patents,
oh, wow.
20, 30 publications in a very short time, because we were working day and night. We'd set up like an assembly line almost. And we did discover a superconducting material that was an even higher temperature than the liquid nitrogen, not much higher, but a little higher than
yeah.
liquid nitrogen. People really want a room temperature superconductor, but we never got there.
That's a big leap
from
liquid nitrogen temperature to room temperature.
Huge leap. But I remember at the time there was much excitement in the world and excitement at DuPont. They had, in those days, they would call it the executive committee.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a board meeting, and they brought all these board members to see this amazing thing called a superconductor, and you know, you could levitate it. So you could put a magnet, liquid nitrogen, and then have this pellet of a superconductor. It would float around in the air, and people
wow.
were fascinated by this levitation. So I got a lot of visibility, I got a lot of press, and our source of information was the New York Times every day and the Wall Street Journal. I mean, there wasn't time to read journals yet. That nothing had appeared in the journals.
Right.
It was quite a fascinating time in history. This is about 1987, 1987,
or so. Now, did you know any of the people at IBM? Who
no,
had
I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. And there was a professor at in Texas who had come up with this copper base and superconductor that was supposed to be was touted as being the most practically useful. Well, we were determined to produce something that was even better,
mm-hmm.
but we had gone and talked to the professor in Houston and obtained some licensing rights to the material if it should ever become useful and we wanted to license it.
Right.
So, but we worked at a feverish pace, I remember. I remember coming in all hours of the night because it was just an electric time, I would say. Had lots of fun. We had the best time. And the group was terrific. And so it was almost inevitable that the people in electronics by now who had gotten to know me
mm-hmm.
would suggest that I come and work there.
Right.
Leave my comfort zone in central research and come out and work in electronics. And, you know, after having turned down job opportunities three or four times because I loved what I was doing, and I didn't see the need to move into a business group. I was a researcher at heart, and the fact that I'd been here 12, 13 years, you know, today I tell young ones that, you know, the sooner they can get some business experiences, the better off they'll be. But I didn't follow that advice in my career.
Had anyone given you that advice?
Not until then.
Okay.
So I had, then when I, you know, they came and talked to me, there was a gentleman in electronics who was the head of the research area that came and talked to me and suggested, and after I turned him down two or three times, he finally came and said, "Look, Uma, this is the last time I'm going to ask you. And you should understand that, yes, you're a research manager, but you're not going to get any more responsibility at DuPont unless you get some business experience."
Mm-hmm.
Those were tough words.
Yeah.
But I took them to heart, and I said, well, I guess I better go if I want more responsibility. Although I didn't see the need at that time, at that point in time. There wasn't the ambition of becoming chief
yeah.
technology officer. So I went to electronics and was the first woman to get a lab director kind of position. I had a lot of firsts because
yeah.
I was among the first women to in management at DuPont. And so I was paving new ways and paving new pathways, but hopefully making life easier for the next
mm-hmm.
lot of women that were coming through. And by now we had begun hiring a lot of women. This was 88, 90 kind of time frame. We started looking at the possibility of bringing 50% of women and minorities.
Oh, wow.
I remember at that time our leadership saying, we really think we should aim at that. We may not be able to achieve those standards, but we ought to try to do that. So there was already beginning to be a lot of focus on giving women more opportunity, etc.
Now, were you involved? I mean, you had said that for various groups that you are in charge of, you know, you got to pick people and you hired people and
yes,
things.
Yes, I did.
But were you involved in kind of the general hiring, maybe going out to MIT or to Caltech to
did
help
I
with
go
recruiting?
Out and recruit? I was not one of the recruiters.
Okay.
Yeah. The people that I hired were through personal connections with professors.
Okay.
I didn't personally go and do that. Would have been a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
I would do some of the orientation when they arrived.
Okay.
But I didn't actually personally go out and recruit. I don't know if there was, you know, today it's different. They ask for volunteers to go out to the campuses to recruit. In those days, I don't remember in central research people going out to campuses. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
Maybe they did. I just don't remember.
Yeah, and I mean, we have so many oral histories in our collection
right.
of people, especially at DuPont. And, you know, certainly at an earlier point than this, people always just talk about hiring people in from universities
correct.
Through their own connections.
Correct.
You know, they worked for Professor
correct.
So-and-so,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
then there's kind of a constant stream of
mm-hmm,
people from
mm-hmm.
that professor. But I don't know, maybe campus recruiting is a much more recent thing than I think.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember when it began, this much broader.
But if you weren't involved in it,
no
reason for you
yeah.
to remember.
Yeah, right. Right. So, leaving this corporate research lab and going into one of the business-supported research areas happened in about 1988,
mm-hmm.
11 years after I joined DuPont. And again, I was certainly influenced by the head of the research organization there who had convinced me to go over. So now, he was quite a good mentor and allowed me to have a say in how the research was being fashioned. As a lab director, I wasn't... there's a distinction between an R&D director and a lab director.
Okay.
Or there was in those days. So the lab director was responsible for all the administration, the facilities, the communication with the site, things like that. And we had sectors in those days. So electronics was a sector,
mm-hmm.
with several businesses in the sector. And there was sector level R&D. I was given sector level R&D. And I was supposed to learn enough about the different businesses and pick a program that would have an impact on one or more of those businesses. So that's what we did. There were several groups over here. It was at the experimental station up the hill,
okay.
in a building up the top of the hill. And very good group. I had two women supervisors who cared enough. I have one experience stands out. I was a new director in that lab. I'd only managed in central research. I hadn't managed in a business organization. They came and suggested that we go and have a drink before we went home, just to get to know each other, etc. This is about 6-7 months after I had joined them already, and we went out to a restaurant here in Powder Mill, around
mm-hmm.
Powder Mill Square, and we ordered 3 glasses of wine, I remember, and after, we had started to chat and get to know each other, they really unloaded on me about all the things I was doing wrong. That took a lot of courage on their part.
It did.
They were managers reporting to me, but they wanted to help me because I had had a lot of this drive and desire to get things done quickly and was, asking for the impossible in an impossibly short time and getting impatient when people couldn't deliver. It was a different trait of my personality that was emerging, and I can never thank them enough for the way they told me how insensitive I was being, and that this was not the approach that was going to make me successful.
Right.
It was very sweet of them. And I thanked them profusely, and they became good friends, actually. One of them is still around. The other one left to go, and she decided she wanted to go teach high school.
Oh.
But they were great.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole group was very, very good. And I became a lot more understanding. I learned a lot about the electronics. It was so different after having been in a research environment. Today, everything's very transparent. Everybody talks about the stock price. Everybody talks about what was the revenue each quarter, what were the earnings, or how did this business do, how did that business. There was none of that in those days. Nothing, nothing. It was completely opaque. And there were more layers of management, and things were very different. And so I hadn't yet learned to read a balance sheet even. and or an income statement.
Right.
And it's just amazing to me how different the world is today. Today, when kids come in, they already know these things. They often had minors in business, and not true in those days. So I did that for a couple of years. And
well, I think I'm going to pause you for 1 second, and then I have a couple more questions about that. But let's just take a quick break.
Sure.